Well, we're into our next unit on the West, and so we're going to talk a lot about Indians and Indian Wars and the industrialization of the West with the Transcontinental Railroad and also with ranching and mining. And we'll also talk about what a business the West becomes, at the same time talking about the closing of the American West. Let's remember for centuries that the Plains Indians had existed in the West. They had lived nomadic lifestyles. There's no question that the horse and the buffalo were very important to the type of communal and nomadic living that Native Americans were doing in the West, whether you were Sioux, Cheyenne, Apache, Nez Perce, Blackfeet. You know, it was the Nez Perce Indians that had helped Lewis and Clark gather horses to get across the mountains, to get further west during their journey and their search for the Northwest Passage. But let's remember something about the Plains Indians. They used every part of the kill. Not only did they worship the animal that they were going to harvest, but they used every part of the kill. This is going to be a major difference between Europeans and white settlers coming across the continent versus Native Americans. White settlers won't use every part of their kill, and we'll talk a little bit about it. Remember from American One that you had the California Gold Rush in 1848. This is going to bring a lot of people west looking for fame and fortune or looking to get out of what they were already in back east, okay? Let's remember that the Gold Rush changed a lot of people's fortunes. A good example is Levi Strauss. Levi Strauss was a German. He was a tent maker. And he realized that as a result of the Gold Rush, people were going to need a durable pant. So he, you know, innovates a little bit, and he develops a pair of jeans. And so hence, some of us today are wearing Levi's. In 1862, you had the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act provided 160 acres of land as long as a homesteader would promise to work it for 5 years. Homesteading was very isolated, particularly for women. People are going to suffer from fires on the plains and grasshopper blights and locust blights. Homesteading could be very isolating. However, if you were coming from back east where you didn't own any property, that was could be a very, very, very good thing. And also the Pacific Railway Act is going to create the inertia needed to build the Transcontinental Railroad. The Transcontinental Railroad is going to be completed in 1869, built principally by two railroad corporations, the Union Pacific Railroad and the Central Pacific Railroad. The Central Pacific Railroad was largely built going from west to east, largely built by Chinese laborers. These Chinese laborers were coming over from the Pacific. They were very different than Americans at that time. They could predominantly be members of the Buddhist faith. And in a Protestant country, that was very, very different. If you read the journals of people back then, they talk about how different the Chinese are. They were not only very industrious, but for instance, they boiled and ate every part of the chicken. They failed to cut its head and the feet off. And for Irishmen working on the other railroad, the Union Pacific Railroad, going from east to west, this could be very different. But let's stop here and make a point. The Transcontinental Railroad, completed in 1869, the model for all other transcontinental railroads across the world, was completed with immigrant labor. Let's make a point here. Railroads are going to stimulate other industries. The government of the United States will offer contracts and certain amounts of money per land that has to be graded and where track has to be laid, where a tunnel has to be erected through the mountains. So the government will give contracts to these railroad companies to make this happen. When the Transcontinental Railroad is completed, it begins this idea that, hey, you know, we need some kind of time zones. It helps to bring about the evolution of catalog stores, Sears and Roebuck, Montgomery Ward, Woolworths. So, you know, something to think about, but the railroad could be considered the first modern corporation because it's principally going to be in league with the federal government. This leads to one of the worst economic scandals in history at that point, the Credit Mobilier scandal during the Grant administration, where there had been some insider trading between members of the railroad company and U.S. congressmen. So, you know, this is another example that government is growing, but it's not growing fast enough to regulate the kind of business industries and things that are happening at this time. Well, back to Indians. At the same time that we're fighting the Civil War, you're going to have Indian-white relations are not very, very good. Treaties are broken repeatedly between Native Americans and white folks, principally because, you know, out west, gold is discovered, silver is discovered, copper is discovered. And so there'll be a rush of settlers into these areas. In 1859, you had the Fort Laramie Treaty, and the Fort Laramie Treaty principally decided that the Black Hills of what becomes South Dakota will always be Indian land for the Sioux Nation. This was its most sacred space. But there's a problem. Gold is discovered in the Black Hills, so the United States military will be sent into the Black Hills to protect the miners. In 1864, around the times that in that same year that you had the Battle of Atlanta, you had the election of 1864, you have one of the worst Indian massacres in American history, the Sand Creek Massacre. Black Kettle, the leader of the Indians camped at Sand Creek, had already signed a treaty with the American military. And he was told, hey, if American military is coming into your area, put up an American flag and then put up a white flag underneath. And that will be a sign to the American military that, hey, we are peaceful. We've already signed a treaty. John Shivington, a military leader and Methodist minister, didn't really care about that. And so using some Indian scouts, he will go in to the Sand Creek area near what was Denver City at the time, out west, and massacre Indians. His very famous quote about this was that nits make lice. In other words, to echo William Tecumseh Sherman, the only good Indian was a dead Indian. It took until this century, the 21st century, for the Methodist Church as a governing body to apologize for what John Shivington and his people did at Sand Creek. Obviously, the worst defeat for American military forces out west during the Indian Wars was the Battle of Little Bighorn. And this occurred just days before the 100th anniversary or the 100th birthday of the United States. You know, what we really know today is that when Custer and his men, over 200 of them, are killed at the Battle of Little Bighorn as one part of three armies attacking the Indians along the Greasy Grass, the Little Bighorn River, Custer made a lot of mistakes, and he should have waited for the other people to come up, but he did not. And so very much outnumbered, as Indians said later, it took about as long for Custer to die as it takes a hungry man to eat his dinner. But Custer stays alive in memorials, particularly constructed by his wife, Elizabeth Custer. She ended up writing about five books about Custer and his men. The following year after the Battle of Little Bighorn, Chief Joseph, otherwise known as Thunder Rolling Down from the Loftier Mountain Heights, will lead the American military on a huge chase through Montana, through little bit to Canada and back into what becomes the United States. And he will eventually surrender. And roughly translated and later written down by a white lieutenant, he makes a statement. And he says, from this point on, I will fight no more forever. And it becomes a very famous statement by Native Americans during this time. You know, the Transcontinental Railroad will mess with buffalo migrations. There had to be buffalo hunters to feed the workers on the Transcontinental Railroad. So one of the things that Native Americans are very upset about is the destruction of their livelihood. And so Native Americans during this time basically had two choices: stay and fight or move on to a reservation. And in other words, our big vocabulary word that results with that is assimilation. And assimilation means moving someone from one culture to the other. Helen Hunt Jackson will write a book about the terrible treatment that Indians are receiving on the reservations, and you want to remember it. Sometimes it shows up as a primary source document. And Helen Hunt Jackson's book is called A Century of Dishonor. And her argument is that we're dishonoring these wonderful Native American peoples by trying to assimilate them. The main act that attempted to assimilate Indians, signed by the U.S. government in 1887, was the Dawes Act. And the Dawes Act, much like the Homestead Act for white settlers, tried to divide these Plains Indians who were used to nomadic hunting with the horse and the buffalo, tried to give them private parcels of land on the reservations to farm. This did not go over too well, and frankly, it leads to a lot of poverty. Much like the Homestead Act, where settlers got 160 acres of land, Native American families under the Dawes Act were given 160 acres of land. But the intent was to detribalize Indians, to give them more of an individual slash private property focus. And again, this does not go well because the Native Americans don't look at things like private property. Some Native American tribes did not want to dig into Mother Earth, did not want to dig into something very sacred. And so, on one hand, white politicians, very happy about the Dawes Act, feel like they're doing right by the Indian, but this did not help Native American peoples. Eventually, most of the land anyway was bought very cheaply by U.S. government or state officials for railroads and for other projects, and so reservations will shrink over time. In 1890, you have a movement, and that movement is called the Ghost Dance Movement. The Ghost Dance was, as some Native American peoples describe it, was a prayer. And two things, if you did the Ghost Dance correctly, were supposed to happen. The buffalo were going to come back in droves, and also that white folks would somehow be removed from the plains. In December of 1890, you have an event at Wounded Knee in South Dakota. And Wounded Knee was a creek, but Indians were taken there by the U.S. cavalry. And Sitting Bull had just been killed. Sitting Bull had once been an avid ghost dancer, but he quit. But the ghost dance made a lot of white politicians on the reservation very skittish. And at Wounded Knee, on a cold December in 1890, there'll be a battle between Indians and white soldiers. Some people call it a massacre of over 200 Indian men, women, and children. The significance of Wounded Knee is that it is the end of Indian resistance on the plains. And that is something that we want to remember. So by 1890, Indian resistance to white encroachment is largely ended. And that'll pave the way for U.S. migration, U.S. industrialization, and further and continued movement west. Thank you.